If you are an average person that goes into Starbucks and you are listening to this with your earbuds in, you were probably so offended by it that you wouldn't want to drink coffee unless you were truly jonesing.
That's Rob Walt, the podcasting master. And this is Writer's Voice, where the conversation goes deeper. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We'll hear an interview with Rob Walt in the second half of our show. But right now, we have author and self-publishing expert Peter Bowerman on the line. He's the author of several books on writing and marketing, The Well-Fed Writer, Financial Self-Sufficiency as a Freelance Writer in 6 months or Less, and a sequel to that book, The Well-Fed Writer, Back for Seconds. He worked in sales and marketing for 15 years before becoming a freelance commercial writer in 1993, writing for such companies as Coca-Cola, MCI, and UPS. His newest book is The Well-Fed Self-Publisher, How to Turn One Book into a Full-Time Living. In it, he lays out the path and tools for writers to actually make a living off their writing. He says over the last 5 years, he's created a full-time living from his self-published books. And we have him on the line right now. We're going to bring him up on the phones. Peter Bowerman, can you hear me?
I can.
Welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, Francesca.
You know, a few weeks ago, we had Shel Horowitz, who I think you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, on the show, and he talks about the daunting obstacles facing authors who want to get their books published. I wonder if you could briefly cover some of these, and then tell us why, in your book, The Well-Fed Self-Publisher, why you say authors should try self-publishing first.
Well, I think it's just gotten harder and harder over the last 10, 15 years for authors to attract a publisher. And once they do, it's no real prize. That's the thing. I mean, a lot of people feel like, oh, if I can just land a publisher, all my problems will be solved. And the fact is that you give up the rights, and you give up control of the process, and you give up the timetable. It's really out of your hands. And, of course, you're giving up most of the profits. And the ultimate insult is that you're still expected to do most of the marketing yourself. So that being the case, I think there are very few reasons to not self-publish, really.
I hear all of that. It is a really difficult prospect to try and get published. But self-publishing doesn't really have the same credibility, it seems, that going the regular route does. So what do you answer to that?
Well, that's a good question. And there's no question that there was a point in time where, and to a large extent it's still true, that self-publishing was synonymous with poor production quality, and it was kind of that last resort sort of thing, you know, the fallback if you just can't land a publisher. But I have just found that the standards and the industry respect and the quality of the books are rising. And more importantly, to answer your question, why does anybody have to know that it's self-published? You know, this is one of those things where if somebody asks you who your publishing company is, you just name, well, it's a small, in my case, I live in Atlanta, Georgia. It's a small company in Atlanta, Georgia. You probably haven't heard of them. And there's no need for someone to even know that it's a self-published book.
Maybe that's true for the general public, but what about distributors or bookstores? Because one thing Shel Horowitz talked about was that when you buy the ISBN, which is kind of the number of your book,
yep, right?
That those that self-publishers tend to buy, unless you're buying 100 different ISBNs, it's pretty obvious that you are a self-publisher.
Why, because you're buying only 10 at a time?
That's right.
You know, I guess you could dwell on those things that, you know, that could be perceived that way. And I just guess I never did. And I heard the same thing. I think Fern Rice, who writes The Publishing Game, suggests that you buy 100 ISBNs for $800 instead of, you know, 10 for $200. Because it'll just look better to the publishing industry. And, You know, I don't know that that's really necessary. And maybe a lot of other people have had worse experiences than I have, but I just pretty much got out there and just presumed, insinuated myself into the publishing arena, and I've done quite well. And this could be part of maybe a follow-up question, but my approach was such that I was not really courting the mainstream media anyway, so I really couldn't care less if, you know, the guy at a newspaper knows I'm self-published. So what? Because I'm going after a niche market, and the people that I'm contacting are happy to hear from me.
And that's one of the points of your book, isn't it? Talk a little bit more about niche marketing. Does niche marketing mean that you're not going to be selling a lot of books?
No, that's not necessarily at all. I would say niche marketing to me means simply, in my case, my books were books about freelance writing. And so I was not going to appeal to a broad swath of people. I would appeal to that segment of the population who had a dream to be a writer. And, you know, you and I both know there's a lot of those, but it's not the same kind of appeal as for a book about dieting or relationships or financial security or religion, you name it, you know, the kind of the mainstream topics. So for that reason, I focused, and let me backtrack a second, as a unknown author of a niche book, you learn pretty quickly that the mainstream media really doesn't care about you. And yes, I could beat my head against the wall for months on end trying to get their attention. And sure, I'm going to, you know, law of averages, I'm going to get somebody's attention, but it's not worth the effort. So instead, I took a very different approach with my book. I said, okay, who are the audiences for my book? And I zeroed in, obviously, number one audience is writers, both established and aspiring. At-home moms, women who had been in the workplace and who wanted to leverage their past work experience into a lucrative, flexible sideline income. Of course, this is the subject of my first two books, The Commercial Writing Field, Writing for Businesses. Home-based business seekers, 55-plus market. All of these groups have huge web presences out there. There's hundreds of websites, you know, in the aggregate for all of these audiences. So I contact those websites. I contact the webmaster. I try to get a review copy into their hands and, in essence, ask, can you review my book? You want to do an interview like we're doing now, for instance? Can we do a Q&A? Can I write an article for your site or some combination of all the above? And because I know my audiences, I'm getting a much better reception than would be the case if I'm contacting the Atlanta Journal-Constitution or the Dallas Morning News, and I'm hoping that I'm going to catch that reporter, that journalist, on the right day in the right time on a slow news day where maybe my story might be of interest.
Yeah. Okay, so you're saying with niche marketing, you've got the ability to really know your audience and go out there, but what if you're
zero in on them.
And zero in on, exactly. But what if you're a typical, I think I'm pretty typical actually as an author. I hate marketing. I don't know anything about it. All I really want to do is write, and I'd like to have people
right.
read my writing.
Right.
What are some of the biggest bugaboos that authors have about marketing?
Well, okay, I'm really glad you brought that up. First of all, the biggest problem is that people are walking around with some idea of what marketing is, and they're really wrong. And they've turned marketing into this terribly scary, daunting process that you have to be just an expert, you know, from birth in your genes or something to be able to do well at. And I disagree with that completely. As you probably remember from my book, I offer up, you know, my humble version of marketing, which is simply nothing more than letting the world, and in the case of a self-publisher, the world is, you know, your distributors and your bookstore sellers and your wholesalers and ultimately your buying public, letting the world know you're out there in a variety of ways on a consistent basis and with a message that they can hear through the clutter. That's all that marketing is. It's nothing more complicated than that. And as I really go to great pains to convey in my book, I truly assert that success as a self-publisher is far more about a process than an aptitude. It's far more about a lot of things that you need to do than some way you have to be.
Well, one of the things I liked, for example, about your book is that you said, okay, what you heard back from people after your first books was that they really wanted the details. They didn't want to be told you have to write a press release. They wanted to be told, how do you write a press release? And that, you know, you kind of have a laundry list. Talk about some items on that laundry list. I mean, we'll get into more, but what might be some of the first things somebody would do in order to start out with publishing their own work?
Oh, boy. Okay. You know, there's obviously sort of a toolkit of items that you're going to need to start, you know, the promotion process. And that includes a press release, obviously. In the case of a niche market approach, it's coming up with a standard email pitch that you would approach these web-based entities to try to get them to take a review copy. So you would have your press release, and you would have the standard email pitch that you would approach the review copy targets with, and that's a good place to start. And then as you get into it, more and more pieces will, you know, sort of become apparent. And one thing, Francesca, that I had discovered with my second book, and I use it again with my third book, and this is a real secret weapon that should bring some aid and comfort to a lot of aspiring self-publishers, and that is using interns to kind of handle the heavy lifting grunt work of sort of the promotional battle. And that, by that I mean, once you zeroed in, I'll give you a good example with the book that I just came out with. I hired somebody this summer. She was going to be a senior at the University of Georgia this fall, and I gave her a copy of the book, or the galley at that point, and had her read it so she understood what the book was and who I was trying to reach and that kind of thing. Then I set her up with some standard email pitches. I set her up with the promotional list for my second book, which was very similar. And so her job was to confirm with all these people, A, that they were interested in getting a review copy as well of this book, as well as, you know, as they had the earlier one. And then from there, build a larger list with some guidelines from me. And then I just set her loose. And while I was off doing my commercial writing work for some, you know, pretty nice hefty hourly rates, I was paying her $8 or $9 an hour to do all of this contacting grunt work, and she loved it because she could do it from her laptop any time of the day or night. And the upshot is, by the end of the summer, I had a list of about 175 confirmed people, all of whom had been contacted and all of whom agreed that yes, we'd love to get a review copy, and yes, we will do a review, or you can write an article. And that cost me probably $600 or $700 over the course of the summer, and, you know, 3 or 4 meetings at my local Starbucks, and that was it.
That's I'm going to just stop you for a moment so that our listeners can know that you are listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Peter Bowerman about his book, The Well-Fed Self-Publisher: How to Turn One Book into a Full-Time Living.
And can I toss in my URL real quick?
Please do.
www.wellfedsp, as in self-publisher, wellfedsp.com.
We have a link to it on our website at writersvoice.net. So cool. If folks want to go to that after the show, you have a lot of information right on that website that can be of use to people.
And I also have, and if I may resort to, a 30-second marketing thing here, but it's germane to the conversation. I created a companion ebook to The Well-Fed Self-Publisher. And in essence, what I did was I sat down and I looked through all of my files, and I gathered every piece of marketing material that I created in the course of my successful book campaigns. And just so people have a sense, and this isn't to brag, this is just to give them a sense of what's possible. By successful, I mean I have sold 50,000 copies of my first two books, and
wow,
they have together provided me a full-time living for over 5 years, which is not a typical outcome.
That's not, but you know, I want to ask you about that. You've written these are how-to books, and
yes,
they do have a market that is hungry for information.
Yes.
What about folks who are writing, let's say, creative nonfiction, much less fiction? I mean, understand there are some genres of fiction like science fiction or romance that may have some ready audiences out there. But, you know, let's take a book of essays or take a book of
yeah,
commentary, political commentary, things like that. Can this really work for them?
Well, there's no question that a nonfiction how-to book is probably the easiest genre to self-publish because, as you say, people are so hungry for information and it's very easy to zero in on your target audience. With just straight nonfiction, creative nonfiction, you know, who knows? I'm not going to say it's not possible, but it is a different animal. But again, it's a matter of if it's a type of book where you can sit down, you can think, okay, who would be the audience for this book, and where does that audience hang out online or anywhere else? You know, what kind of publications do they read? But in my case, it was where do they hang out online? And then you approach it from that standpoint. So it's, you know, somewhat formulaic. And, yeah, I think it's probably going to be a little more difficult because people will buy creative nonfiction for different reasons than they would buy a how-to book. In my case, you know, here was a book where people could start a whole new career, a very lucrative career writing. And so, you know, the well-fed writer, I mean, that has some appeal to it. So,
especially since so many are not all that well-fed.
Exactly. That was the whole idea. So, yeah.
I wanted to ask you about something else, bookstore signing. Now, this is something, you know, most authors are going to be ready to go on a book tour if they are published in the typical way.
Right.
How does a self-published author do this kind of a thing? And, you know, it's hard enough, actually, often even to get people to a bookstore for an established author. So what kind of chance does somebody have who's self-published to get somebody to come see them?
Why do they have to know that they're self-published? When you go to a Barnes & Noble and you see those little signs, you know, come, you know, next Tuesday night at 7 o'clock where so-and-so will be, you know, signing their book or discussing their book or whatever, I don't have any idea whether that book is self-published or not.
Okay, so how would you drive people there? What are some good things for people to know about book signing?
Well, first of all, I'm not a big fan of book signings as a real way to move a lot of books. For starters, that bookstore is going to be ordering those books through Ingram, you know, so you're going to, you know, make some money, but
through
you're
whom?
Not going to make nearly as much money as if you were, you know, selling them on your own.
Who are they going to be ordering them from?
They're going to be ordering them from Ingram, who is, of course, mm-hmm, the big wholesaler for the bookstores, for the what's known as the trade. When a bookstore wants to order books, they don't want to go to tens of thousands of individual publishers to get what they need, so they go to one place. So, you know, you get 20 people to a book signing, which is a pretty good turnout. You know, in case of my book, 55% discount that Ingram gets, that's $9 I'm grossing before my expenses. So, you know, 20 people, I might have made $100. Okay, well, you have to do a whole lot of those for that to pan out, especially if you're talking about, you know, traveling. And so... I don't know that it's all that worth it. But to answer your question, how do you get them to the store? You get them to the store like you would promote anything. You send press releases out. You might ask the Barnes & Noble for their media list, because oftentimes they have a media list which they're sending stuff out to, and they're only too happy to have you share a little bit of that promotional burden and do some of that legwork yourself. And they appreciate that fact that you have an author that's willing to do a little work. you know, you'll probably get in the newsletter of theirs if they're on top of things. And so for that reason, it's good to try to schedule your book signing for as later in the month as possible in a particular area. That way you're in the newsletter for that much longer. You know, if the newsletter comes out, you know, on the first of the month and your book signing is on the third, well, you haven't really taken advantage of that vehicle too much.
Here's another question, too. I'm going to ask one more how-to-ish kind of question or question about the details, and then I've got a more philosophical question. POD, or point of demand, is that what it stands
print
for? Print on demand, of course. Your chapter about that asks the question, is that a dream or a disappointment? What's the upside, what's the downside of print on demand?
Okay. Print on demand, of course, is very hot because it offers authors the illusion that they are getting out into the mainstream publishing world, but for a fraction of the cost of what self-publishing would cost. And they're breaking down those barriers heretofore sealed off for the average publisher, locked out of the, you know, publishing world. And the truth is a little more prosaic, I guess. And here's the thing people have to understand about print-on-demand. Print-on-demand is simply a technology. It's a digital printing technology that allows for the relatively, and I'll come back to that word in a second, relatively cost-effective printing of a book at a time. And it's not a revolution. It's not some marketing miracle. It's just a technology. Now, the problem that most authors run into is their hope and their naivete get the better of them, and they're in essence sold on all of these promises that POD is making. But you have to understand the fundamental POD business model, and that is, and this is where you have to start thinking like a business person, not like a writer, and that is that they get their money, they make the lion's share of their profits overwhelmingly when they sign authors up. You know, disk space is not an endangered species, and so it costs them almost nothing to load another book on their site, and for anywhere from $700 to $1,500, they will lay out your book and design your book cover within very strict parameters.
And we've got about 10 seconds left on this.
Oh, okay, okay. And so bottom line, they have every incentive to sign up as many authors as possible and almost no incentive to promote the ones that they do sign up because they know that 99% of the books won't make any money.
So you suggest that people actually go out and get somebody who can print a book in enough copies so that you can send out review copies to folks, enough review copies, and actually get the buzz out around your book. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if somebody's goal simply is, I want to be an author, I want to say I'm an author and have the book available for friends and family, then print-on-demand is a good way to go. If you're not trying to make money, my whole approach is this book only applies if your goal is to make a significant amount of money with your book. You know, all bets are off if that isn't your goal.
So, right. Well, that's great. And my final question, and again, we only probably have about 30 seconds to answer it, and that is, you say that there are more and more books that are being self-published that are they're getting better and better. Why do you think that's so?
Well, there are whole industries that have cropped up to serve the self-publisher. I mean, I mentioned in my book, it's kind of like you buy a car and all of a sudden you notice the car everywhere. You get into the self-publishing field and all of a sudden you realize there are associations and contests and conferences and printers and editors and designers.
Saying that there's a lot more resources out there, in other
There's a lot of resources out there, and it'll blow your mind how many.
And people are getting more savvy about using them? Is that why it's just getting better?
Well, I think it's become more acceptable, and it's become much more of an option, you know, because people can't seem to land publishers. And so all of a sudden they're starting to think, maybe landing a publisher isn't even the best option anyway.
Well, Peter Bowerman, the book is The Well-Fed Self-Publisher, How to Turn One Book into a Full-Time Living, and I want to thank you very much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Francesca, thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
All right, great. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that was Peter Bowerman. You can go on his website, thewellfedsp.com, and we also have a link on writersvoice.net. Stay tuned for our interview with podcast pioneer Rob Walsh about his book, Tricks of the Podcasting Masters. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. You've probably heard the word podcasting, but if you're like most folks, you're probably not entirely clear about what that means. But a lot of people are listening to podcasts. Apple estimates about 75% of iPod owners are listening to podcasts, and there are plenty of folks using other MP3 players to listen to them too. And the numbers of subscribers are going up by leaps and bounds. Some people say that having a podcast will become like having a blog or even a web page, something millions of people do to get the word out there about themselves or their work. Rob Walsh is host of Podcast 411, the podcast and website devoted to podcasting. He's a podcast consultant to Senator John Edwards and Governor Bill Richardson. He's also a member of the Podcasting Specification Working Group, which is developing ways for podcasting and podcast subscription software to be standardized across the internet. And you'll find out what subscription means in our interview that follows. Now, Rob Walsh has come out with a terrific book, Tricks of the Podcasting Masters. Along with his website, Podcast 411, it'll teach you everything you need to know about creating a podcast and making sure that potential subscribers know about it, too. Rob Walsh, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me.
Podcasting was practically an unknown phenomenon just 2 years ago, and it's been growing by leaps and bounds since then. Why don't you first give us a definition of podcasting, because I think a lot of folks have a fairly fuzzy idea of it, and then I'll ask you a little bit more about the history of it.
Okay. Podcasting is really nothing more than the delivery of rich media files, and the rich media files can be an audio file like an MP3 file or a video file like a .mov, and they are delivered via subscription. The best way to think of this is like a magazine subscription. With a magazine, you have two options. You can go out to the store and hope that the magazine is in the store. If it's not, you have to come back the next day. Eventually, it's there and you buy it. Or you can take that little card out of the magazine and you can fill out the information, send it in, and then whenever the magazine is published, it automatically gets delivered to your house. Podcasting is similar to that, where you, as the listener, subscribe to a show. And when that show is made available, it gets downloaded to your computer. The difference here is your software actually goes out and checks what's called the RSS feed to see if there's a new show available. But it does it all in the background without you having to do anything. And when that new show is available, it downloads it and it makes it available for you. The name podcast came from the fact that once that file is downloaded, it could then be synced to a portable MP3 player. And since iPods are the default MP3 player, the name podcast came.
Yeah, so it's really more than just radio. I think a lot of people think it's kind of like internet radio.
Yeah, it's so much more than internet radio. When you think internet radio, what you're really thinking is streaming. That is, you're locked in your chair at a specific point in time in a specific physical location to listen to that show. Podcasting breaks that. It's what you want, when you want it, where you want it. So you subscribe, the show gets downloaded in the background, and then you listen to it at your leisure when you want to, whether that's driving in your car to work, on the treadmill, walking the dog. I even have a pair of Bose noise-canceling headphones. I listen to podcasts mowing the lawn.
Wow. That's great. I think I'll have to try that. That's the one time I can't listen to the radio, so that's a good suggestion. Listen to podcasts, much less. So it's kind of like TiVo, basically, in that kind of time-shifted way.
Yes.
Okay, so now give us a little thumbnail history of podcasting.
Well, podcasting, you know, there's a debate about what the real history of it is, but it started out with out of the blogging world. And that uses the same tools as blogging, the same RSS feed. And back in 2000 time frame, David Weiner, who's a famous blogger and has written some very important software that helps blogging work in the background, and Adam Curry from MTV fame, the guy with the big hair and was on Headbangers Ball, who's actually really a techno geek, we're talking about a way to get large files delivered in the background so that people didn't have to sit there and click and wait, click and wait. And they thought, you know, hey, why can't we get this enclosure item added into the RSS feed so that people can get rich media files, not just text, but they could get, as a matter of fact, podcasting, you can actually even have PDF files delivered to you. The RSS feed really is nothing more than a treasure map, and it points to where the rich media files are in the Internet, and it sends the listeners or viewers, aggregators of the software, out to go find it. But podcasting, back to your question, where it started, was back in 2000, really out of a conversation between those two. And it took a few years for everything to come together. And then in 2003, there was a person that was taking these MP3 files, and he actually made them as an enclosure, and some people were listening to him. But it really didn't take off until the summer of 2004, when Adam Curry started doing it on a daily basis. And he wrote a script called iPodder, which actually took the file after someone subscribed to it and transferred it from one program into iTunes, which then synced it with an iPod. And he made that software available in September of 2004. Right at that same time, someone said, hey, let's call this podcasting. And between the software being available, the name being available, and at the time, there was a lot of information or press coverage of blogging, the bloggers happened to start talking about it. The press picked up on it, picked up on the name podcast, which is a really neat name because at the time there was a lot of interest also in iPods. And everything just kind of came together in the fall of 2004, and it just caused a snowball effect, and it just started growing. I mean, in September of 2004, a search for podcast resulted in like 35 results in Google. That was a million results by January of 2005, and it's over 250 million results today.
Wow. Now, that iPodder is basically, it's a program by which you can catch podcasts. You can subscribe to them. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And it's called something else right now. Is that right?
Yeah. The original program was iPodder by Adam Curry, and he released that as open source. And then there was another program written right off of that really quickly called iPodder X. And then another one called iPodder Lemon. And because of the name and because it has iPod in it, Apple kind of said, you know, you really can't have that. So iPodder Lemon became Juice. iPodder X became Transistor. That said, people mostly subscribe to podcasts today with iTunes. In June of 2005, Apple made iTunes such that you could go out and subscribe to podcasts. And that's really when podcasting took off. Up until June of 2005, there was probably only a couple hundred thousand people that had ever subscribed to a podcast. Today, the estimate is anywhere from 6 million to 27 million are listening to podcasts.
Now, you made a connection between podcasting and blogging in terms of the history of it. And you also mentioned this rich media content. I went to this conference a few weeks ago called PodCamp that was in Boston. And a lot of folks there said that these are really two paired mediums that can work very well together, blogging and podcasting.
Yeah. The basics of podcasting really come out of the blogging world. There's a lot of podcasters today that maintain their blog with both audio and text information. And you know, sometimes it's a text blog, sometimes it's a podcast blog.
Just to take a little step backward, looking at this as a media phenomenon, and also just in the way of disclosure, I have to say Writer's Voice has a podcast, so I'm totally sold on it. But What is important about this new media form?
I really think it comes down to the convenience for the listener and the convenience for the creator. For a very low cost, I mean, for $5 a month, you can go out to a service called Libsyn.com, Libsyn.com, and you can get a hosting package where you get unlimited downloads. So that means you could have hundreds of thousands of downloads of your show, and you're not going to pay anything more than $5 a month. So what you're looking at is a true democratization of broadcast media. There are more podcasts today than there are radio stations in the world.
Really?
And what it comes down to is people now, without any FCC regulations, without any regulations at all, can make their audio or video available to anywhere in the world for almost nothing, $5, $10 a month.
And how does this differ from something like YouTube?
It's a little bit different from YouTube. YouTube is more of, I would call it a viral, where people are going to say, hey, go look at this, and you're going to go send people to it. Where podcasting is a little more subscription-oriented, where people are going to have an ongoing series. Now, YouTube, you can subscribe. So there is some overlap and similarity with YouTube. YouTube is more on the video side. Podcasting is still 90% audio.
Now, your book, Tricks of the Podcasting Masters, is more oriented to folks who already are or are planning to podcast, that may know something about the medium. But just quickly, for people who want to know the really basic nuts and bolts, where can you tell them to go?
Well, they can go to my website, podcast411.com, and we've got tutorials up there that'll teach them the basics, and they can listen to my show, Podcast 411, which I interview other podcasters to learn how they're doing their podcasts. It's kind of like inside the actor's studio, except for podcasting. So if you take my website and my podcast and then combine it with Tricks of the Podcasting Masters, we'll teach you everything you need to know how to learn how to podcast and how to learn how to do podcast well. And our book was written, you know, okay, hey, I got my podcast up, but now how do I get an audience? How do I make my show good enough to grow my audience? And then where do I promote my show? And if I want to actually monetize my show, how do I do that? And we give, you know, a pretty brutal analysis of what it's going to take to make money podcasting. You're not going to make money podcasting, the vast majority of people.
Right. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with podcast expert Rob Walch about his book, Tricks of the Podcasting Masters. Okay, let's say that we've got some listeners out there who want to start a podcast, but they're not sure what about. What kind of considerations should guide them?
The best advice we always say to people is you want to podcast what's in your heart. What do you do in a regular day or a regular week? Write down your activities. What are the things that you are most passionate about? Are you most passionate about comic books? Are you most passionate about the Tick comic book? Maybe you go out and look and see, is there a podcast on the Tick? Or if there is one, is it any good? If you don't like that one, maybe you do another one. So you can look out there, see what podcasts are out there and something that you're passionate about. If you don't think it's being done well, do it yourself. If you do think it's being done well, then contribute to that podcast. Contact the host of that podcast and give them some material to help on their show. Most podcasters not only want listener feedback, they encourage and beg for it.
And that's one of the benefits of podcasting also in the sense of the blogging is that kind of interactivity with the audience.
Podcast, when it's done well, it connects with the listener. Podcasting is a much more personal medium than radio or television. Think of this. If you're in your car and you turn off the show right now and you go into the grocery store, when you come back and turn it on, it's not going to be where you left off. But with podcasting, if you turn off the podcast when you get to work, when you come back out and click the play button, it'll be exactly where you left off. You actually control it.
But also in terms of user or listener-generated content, some of the most interesting things in your book were examples where folks can get a free voicemail line, and they actually played comments from their listeners on the air. And tell us about that.
There's many different services out there. On my show, as an example, I give people three different ways to send me audio feedback. One is they can record it on their computer and send it to me via Gmail to podcast411@gmail.com. The other one is they can call my number, which is a free voicemail service from k7.net, and my number happens to be 206-MOM-HELP. it just happened to work out that way. But and this number is free to me as the podcaster, and it's just a call, a regular call for someone that has, you know, if you have a cell phone, it's just your minutes. Most people don't pay long-distance bills anymore. Matter of fact, if anybody pays for long-distance phone calls these days, they really need to call their local cable company and get digital phone and or Vonage or something like that. And then the third way is they can go to my website, and I have a little button they can click on, and they can record a message directly from their computer into a service. There's a company called Mobisoft that has a service called Mobitalk. And by recording this message, I get an email that says, hey, you have a new message. I go listen to it, and I can then download it to my computer and put it on my show. Another thing that you can also do with it is you can put a player from that Mobitalk on your website and just enable those messages to make them live. So after I get them, I could also enable them so other people can come in and listen to some recent messages I've received.
It's like posting an audio comment.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And now Mobitalk's also allowing people to record video comments, too.
Wow. Now, we have a general audience, but we also have a subset of listeners who are writers. You have some pretty interesting ideas in the book of how writers can use podcasting.
There's quite a few writers now that are taking their book and either creating a podcast around the book, what they call a patio book, or they're creating a podcast where they talk about what's going on in the book and they get feedback from listeners and readers of the book. One thing that some writers have done is say you have a book and then you're going to have the second book in the series. And the first book, you've pretty much sold as many as you're going to sell. What they've done is then they go and read that book and make that available out to the podcasting community and people that listen to podcasts as a free audiobook, essentially. And then use that as a promotional tool to promote the next book they're about to release. So this is one way to get some good PR for your upcoming books.
In other words, to audiocast a book or podio a book, but that's not the book you're going to publish for money. You're going to set it up for another book? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. One example was an author, and he had the Chronicles of Moravi. And his name was T. Morris, and he was the first one to do a patio book. Well, he had a second book coming out, and it was the second in the series. And what he did was by going back and just recording it as audio, the first book, and then making it available, he grew a audience base. And then once that book was done, it was time to coincide with the release of the new book. So he got everybody through the series, hooked on these characters, and then said, hey, my new book is now available. You can go buy it on Amazon or wherever. So he was able to sell quite a few more books when that book was released than when the original book was released.
Now, what if you wrote a book and podcasted it, but then you want to publish it in print? Can there be problems with that in the sense that publishers may not want to actually publish something that's already been available for free?
Scott Sigler with EarthCore had a book. It was supposed to get published. He had written it, and it did not get published. Just issues came up with the publisher. They decided not to publish it. So he decided to make it available as a free audiobook. After making it available as a free audiobook, he picked up like 6,000-7,000 subscribers to this audiobook. He was then able to convince another publisher to publish the book. So he actually was able to get the book published based on the fact that he had an established audience for the book as an audiobook.
I'm wondering if this is really an example of some changes going on in the publishing industry, because there was a time, I think, really before podcasting, when if you tried to post stuff on the internet, for example, I did publish a story and posted it and links to it on my website, and it is also available on the web by the original publisher. But then when it came time for me to submit it to a contest, I was told, well, we only take original content, and if it's already been previously published, we don't want to look at it. Now, that was a contest, not publishing, but, you know, there was this kind of ethos. A lot of magazines won't take something that's already been published.
From a publisher's point of view, from what I've always been told, it's all about, can you, as an author, publicize your book? Are you going to do good PR? Is this book going to sell? And with the example of Scott Sigler, he was able, you know, this publisher came in and saw he had an established audience already of 6,000 rabid fans. And this was in a medium that almost nobody knew about at the time, which was podcasting. So they were able to take from that and justify going out and making it as a print copy of the story.
Right. You also talk about the POD, or print-on-demand, or self-publishing industry that's gotten into it. Talk a little bit about Lulu.com.
Lulu writers that don't know about it, it's probably one of the biggest right now. I believe it is the biggest print-on-demand publisher out there. And, you know, you go to them with your book, and they'll print anything. So that's where, if you can't get a publisher to do your book, or CD, or any other media, Lulu is a great place to go. And Lulu has embraced the podcasting world because there's a lot of authors that are releasing their stuff as audio books, and they're going to them saying, okay, well, now that you released it, why don't you go ahead and start actually printing some of these and selling them to your fans? So this is small-run self-publishing.
How are they using podcasting?
Well, they're using podcasting to talk about their service. So they're going and they advertise on some different podcasts. My co-author, Mer Lafferty, has two different podcasts. One is called Geek Fu Action Grip, and the other one's called I Should Be Writing. All wannabe writers, it's a really good podcast called I Should Be Writing, and she talks about her trials and tribulations of trying to become a published author, how to deal with rejection and things like that. But Lulu saw her audience as a really good place to go out and advertise and talk about their service. So they were one of her sponsors.
You're listening to Writer's Voice on WMUA, and we're talking with Rob Walch about his book, Tricks of the Podcasting Masters. You know, it kind of sounds to me like, in terms of this promotional capacity of podcasting, we're kind of where we were when web pages first began to be developed. How can other businesses use podcasting as a marketing tool?
You can use podcasting as a marketing tool if you remember a really good rule, and that is it's about the value to the listener. It's a much more personal media. You can't just go and take your website and convert the text on your website to audio and expect people to listen to the podcast. You have to respect the audience because they aren't pulling this information down. This is not a push information. They are making a conscious decision to subscribe to the show and then hit play and listen to it. So they're not going to come across it by accident. Happen to be channel surfing and come across your infomercial at 2 in the morning and go, hey, yeah, I'm going to go out and buy that product. A perfect example of someone that got it wrong is Starbucks. Starbucks, in their initial podcast, which we call the longest 12 and a half minutes in podcasting, was their first episode. And if you listen to it, it will be the longest 12 and a half minutes of your life. It was an example of, if you're an executive at Starbucks, you probably listened to this and said, oh my God, this is a great podcast. If you are an average person that goes into Starbucks and you are listening to this with your earbuds in, you were probably so offended by it that you wouldn't want to drink coffee unless you were truly jonesing. Because in the middle of this podcast, they have an interview with a coffee master, and he starts swirling the coffee around in his mouth, making these vile sounds, and then spitting the coffee out into a platoon. So you hear this guy swishing the coffee in his mouth and then spitting the coffee, not once, not twice, not three times, but four times in this podcast. And this is an area where they forgot, hey, people have these earbuds in their ears. So in the middle of their head, they hear this guy spitting coffee into a platoon.
And I was able to go on the web and download a little bit of a clip from that Starbucks podcast. So let's listen to that now.
The first step in the actual cupping stage is you dip the spoon in, basically taking as much on the spoon, and then you're going to slurp the coffee. And when you slurp, what's going to happen is that coffee is going to atomize, or it's going to kind of spray around the inside of your mouth, coating the entire inside of your mouth. This first coffee that I'm going to taste today, Colombian Reina Supremo.
I think there's only one response to that, and that is, ew.
Yeah. It was an example that whoever was pitching the idea wound up gearing it towards the executives at Starbucks.
So tell us a good example.
A good example of one that I use all the time is called the Swinecast. The Swinecast is a podcast geared towards professional pig producers.
Wow.
It is so niche, and that's what podcasting is about. It's about targeting the niches. And the show talks about different medicines and different medications and different things for producing swine. And if you're a pig producer, this podcast hits exactly what you want to know about. You're out, you're cleaning the troughs, you're around the farm. You're going to hear tips and advice and things that you want to know about. Most people that are listening to this right now have absolutely no desire to listen to the Swinecast. This is not for the everyday person. But from a business perspective, this was a podcast that hit their niche and hit it right. And it understood who their niche market was, and that is producers of swine.
So let's think, there may be a business out there, somebody who runs a business and would like to do a podcast and can think that they have some really great content. Is it really expensive for them to get into doing this?
No, it's not at all. It really is not expensive to get into this. If you don't want to do it yourself, there's plenty of consultants like myself and many others out there that will help do it for you. You can make audio sound just as good as a professional studio in a regular conference room today with the software that's available. People can come to your office and work with you to record it. They can record with you via Skype, and it'll sound just like it was done in a professional studio.
Via Skype?
Via Skype, S-K-Y-P-E. It's a voice over internet, which is a free service, which is a really great way to record conversations. Skype-to-Skype phone calls will sound better than the best phone hybrid system that's on the market, because when you're talking a phone system, I'll get real geeky here, you're limited to a 4 kilohertz bandwidth, which makes your voice sound that hollowy, tinny sound, where Skype is a full digital voice spectrum, and it covers the entire spectrum, so it sounds more rich and robust. But really, for any business, the biggest thing I always say to them is, remember, make the content worth your listeners' time. Don't make it a sales pitch. If 90% or 95% of your content is about educating your listeners on something they're interested in, not so much selling, but something they're interested in, then the show will do well. But if you spend half your time or 25% of your time or 100% of your time selling your product, you won't have a listener base. It's got to be about educating and entertaining your listeners. Give them something that makes it worth their time, and you'll have a loyal listener base.
Well, the book is Tricks of the Podcasting Masters, and my guest has been Rob Walch. He co-wrote the book with Moore Lafferty, and you can go to his website at podcast411. Thank you so much, Rob, for joining us on Writer's Voice today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Hello, and welcome to Swinecast for December 12th. Swinecast, your connection at your convenience, made possible through the support of Elanco Animal Health, and is a production of Truffle Media Networks. A couple of times a week, we hook up to share what we've learned about what you've said you're interested in. Now, I hasten to add, I use the term you in a clearly universal manner. May not be your particular cup of tea, but we're hoping it'll open a new line of thought somewhere, like this issue faced by the poultry industry. Just over the weekend, a recent study from Consumer Reports, in which an overwhelming majority of the birds sporting Campylobacter in the meat case. Dr. Norman Stern of the Agricultural Research Service explains the article.
And that is Swinecast. That was the podcast that Rob Walch said was an example of the way you want to do it. Hungry for more? Go to writersvoice.net to hear a web-exclusive segment from our interview with Rob Walch, where Walch talks about copyright issues, podcasting equipment, and the possibilities and difficulties of actually making money from podcasting. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice, airing on this station and podcasting on the web at writersvoice.net. Please send your comments about the show, suggestions for authors you'd like to hear, or anything else you'd like to tell us to write@writersvoice.net. Next week, we're going to be talking with poet and author Richard Michelson. If you listened to the show last week, you heard him read from his latest children's book, Across the Alley. Next week, he talks about his poetry and others of his books, particularly his children's books. We also hear an interview with Dylan Schaefer about his memoir, Life, Death, and Bialys. Until next week, I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. You've been listening to Writer's Voice, a weekly radio show airing on community radio stations across the country, streaming on the web at WMUA.org and ValleyFreeRadio.org, and podcasting at writersvoice.net.